Welcome to the second episode of Around the Wheel with Brett Tax, and tonight, Mark Wallace. Mark Wallace is a wonderful guest. He is a world traveler. He's been traveling since 2014, and 2 years into his trip, he realized that he had missed the mark. He was traveling with trains, planes, and automobiles and decided to switch over to motorcycles exclusively. He's over 50 countries into his travels, and what makes Mark special, besides being stuck and quarantined in Argentina for the whole COVID thing that's going on in the world right now, is he's a photographer. And he's also a blogger. So he's on YouTube and he's got some magnificent photos. I've been looking at your website, Mark. It's incredible. So it's markonabike.com. You guys need to check this out after you listen to the podcast. And believe me, you're going to want to. We talked a little bit before we got started here. Mark and I chatted for a bit to go, what shall we chat about? And we decided we were going to have a nice chat about the most critical skills for travel, and specifically international travel, because both Mark and I share that dream, but we do things a little differently. So Mark, I know that you put together a list because you showed it to me. It's a massive list of different skills. So let's narrow this down and let me go, what is the most critical travel skills or travel lessons that you've had in your a lot of years of travel now?
Yeah, well, thank you, first of all, so much for having me on the show, on the podcast. This is going to be a blast. I've been looking forward to this since you reached out. So thanks again. You know, there are tons of skills. Of course, we could talk for hours. But what I try to do is boil this down to the skills that you need mentally, psychologically, emotionally, because a lot of this stuff is in the brain. And then the physical things that you need to know absolutely for certain, the things you need to do on the bike to keep yourself safe. And not surprisingly, a lot of those things they cross over. And so the physical things that you're doing on the bike tend to be very mental, and the mental things that you learn tend to help you with the physical stuff. But both of those things are very important. So I wrote down a list of 10 things. If you're listening to this, you're going to get 10 things that you can take away, write these down. And these are some things that I think, based on my 5+ years of being on a motorcycle around the world, you have to know. You have to know these things.
Well, and you know, Mark and I were chatting before the show. We were chatting earlier this afternoon about, hey, what should we cover, and were there any topics that he wanted to ask me about? And as we got into comparing notes, we found that our notes were almost parallel. You know, the travels that I've had through Africa and South America, and obviously Mark's been through all these on these different continents and countries as well, and spent a lot more time there than I have, that we had some very parallel lessons from this. So this is, please stay tuned because these are fantastic. All right. So what's number one, Mark? What do you put down for your number one?
Well, for the physical stuff, well, first of all, let me back up just a little bit, because the way that you get these skills, I think, is one of the most important things. In fact, the first essential skill that I wrote down was to get the appropriate training. You have to get the appropriate training, both from the mental side and the physical side. The way that you do that is, usually for the physical stuff, it's through training and repetition. It's going to a workshop. It's having somebody teach you how to cover the clutch, how to control the throttle, covering the rear brake, getting your body position, all of that stuff, training and repetition. The other way that you get these skills is through experience, just doing it. The problem with experience, in my experience, is if you use your experience to learn this, the physical stuff, the body position, the sight, the vision, those types of things, if you're going online watching Brett Tax videos, those guys, and you're not getting any training, what happens is you tend to create bad habits that you don't know about. So there are things that you know that you don't know. Maybe you don't know how to control the rear wheel to slide around a corner or something. You maybe work on that. But then the dangerous things are the things that you don't know that you don't know. That's why you need to go to a training session with a physical person so that they can look and say, you're too far back on the motorcycle. Your body's out of position. Your knee needs to be next to the tank. You need to open up to the corner. You need to sit up straight. Your handlebars are too low. You're too much on the throttle. Feather the clutch. Those things. If you don't get the proper and appropriate training for the type of journey that you're doing, you can get into trouble. Well, number one, essential skill.
To kind of jump on with the bandwagon with this, I often learn the most from other trainers, not because they give me information I don't know. Like you said, there's some great videos out there. There's some great books out there. I can talk to people. I can watch people. But to have somebody watch me, somebody with a trained eye, because what I found is many riders that I train think they're doing something and they're not. And
exactly.
I've done the same thing. In fact, and a tip for those that are listening, one of the ways I get around this, because not everybody has the ability to come and see a trainer like me or to get into a school, is I use a lot of video. They're so available now, even cell phones, or just having a friend hold it and video myself. And I do this. I'm not just telling other people to do it. I do this to myself because I'm the most critical coach I can think of when it comes to my riding, because I have somebody else video me. And that's a lot of how some of the videos I started making came about, is I was just doing videos anyways and then critiquing how I was doing it and finding out I didn't always look the way I was supposed to look. I was telling other people to do it. I could coach them, but I wasn't doing it. So you've got a great point there.
Yeah, it's funny. I have some videos on YouTube of me riding, and specifically I have videos of me at a training in Lima, I think, of me doing my first real off-road cornering. It's painful to watch those videos now. I'm like, man, I am so out of position. Of course, this is why the bike is falling over. I'm just, you know, I can hear my trainer yelling, look at me, look at me, look at me. Because I'm looking at the wrong place. I mean, there's so many different things, but you need that person. On the flip side, the experience part of it, that's like how you can learn cultures and languages and things like that. You can short circuit that and go become much quicker at learning that stuff by getting a mentor. And that's also true of the riding skills. If you don't know how to cross a border, if you don't know how to speak a different language, if you don't know what a carne is, if you don't know what TIP is, all that kind of stuff that you need to sort of know, just ride with somebody that's done it and you're going to get their experience. That's what wisdom is. Wisdom is learning from somebody else's experience. So learn from somebody that can teach you.
All right, Mark, I have to ask, what was the first, and Canada doesn't count, what was the first border you crossed, and did you have somebody with you? Or because you're a solo traveler, you do this by yourself. You're not with somebody else, obviously. People who travel for very long periods of time almost are always solo. How did you get across that first border? Did you do it on your own? Did you have help?
Well, I had actually many, many years of travel experience before I did the solo trip on the motorcycle. And so I had, oh gosh, let's see, about 16 years of extensive international travel by myself and with other people before I ever did that. In fact, the 2 years before I, you know, when I did the planes, trains, tuk-tuks, cars, bicycles, all of that stuff, there were many, many border crossings. The difference is I didn't have to get a motorcycle through customs, the aduana, all that kind of stuff. I didn't know how to do it. The way that I learned how to do that is I went to Horizons Unlimited bulletin boards, the hub. I got a lot of information there.
Fantastic website.
Absolutely. There's so many people that are doing what you and I are doing. Like my family, when I said I'm going to ride around the world on a motorcycle, they're like, oh my God, that's insane. I'm like, well, there's probably 5,000 people doing it right now. There's people all over the world doing this from all different countries. It's not that complicated. And the great thing is people share. That's how I got across the border. The other thing that I did, you know, my first border crossing on the bike was into Mexico. It's really easy. I'm from Arizona, so it's pretty simple to get into Mexico. But getting into Guatemala and through Central America, you're getting into some dangerous places. There are fixers, there's some corruption, there are some tips to be paid to the officials getting through those countries. That it was something I had to learn just by grit and understanding. The first time you go through a border, you figure out, okay, here's the system, I have to do these three things. Then you do it again, exiting. Then you do it again, entering the next country. And then you do it again. So over 50 countries now I've gone through. So that's entering and exiting borders. It's over 100 borders that I've crossed on the bike, almost the same every single time.
It is. And I've found in Central America was still possibly the most challenging place I've been. Africa was unique in its own way, but Central America is is so condensed, and there is so narrow of a border, and there's so many North Americans, Americans right. and Canadians going through, that it's quite polluted as far as the money that's brought down, the overpayments that people have, and the expectation that everybody's going to use a fixer. And anybody that's listening, when you travel through borders that are complicated or where there's foreign language, these fixers are people who make their living helping foreigners get across the border. And in some places, it's really quite useful. There's places in Russia or in Africa where this is, and these people are relatively legitimate. They're just trying to make a living. Right. Central America, there are a few, but there are also people who really target Americans and take huge advantage of them. But that's what a fixer is. It's somebody that tries to help you get across the border. And it's not, let's face it. I don't know about you, Mark, but I find that, especially in Central America, they prey on North Americans and our culture. We value our money. We value our privacy. We value our time. We want to get through fast. We want to be treated like an American. And they scare people into paying fees that they shouldn't be paying. It's not the officials. It's the fixers that get you.
Yeah, it's the fixers. And I have videos of me crossing all of the Central American borders. And I used fixers at all of those border crossings, I think, except maybe Nicaragua. I don't remember. But the videos, you can watch those. They're on my YouTube channel on markandabike.com. You can see them. Yeah, and you can see my tolerance from what they're charging me runs out very quickly. So the first border, I think it's, okay, it's $40 or $60 or whatever it was that I was charged. Right. And then you get to the next border and you realize that was way too much. You're like, no, I'm only going to pay this much. And then by the end, I'm bargaining to try to get through for $10 or whatever the cheapest rate I can. But yeah, that's just that experience that I was referring to. Let me talk about the second essential thing that you should know. Vision. It's learning where to look. If you don't have your vision correct, you're going to run into issues specifically on a round the world journey, because the roads are it's not complicated like going to maybe England, you're driving on the wrong side of the road. It's not that kind of complicated. The complications is there are livestock, the roads are not in good condition. If you don't know the language, you don't know the signs say, you don't know if it says fog or cliff or out of commission or detour, you have to learn all that stuff. And so you're trying to navigate all of this unfamiliar territory, and the roads change rapidly. You can be zipping down the road on nice pavement. The next thing you know, you're on unmarked dirt road. Then you're on gravel. And then you're on some sand going around something. Then you're doing a little river crossing. You just don't know what's happening. All of that stuff requires you to be looking in the right place and not being distracted by target fixation. Oh, my gosh, there's a chicken in the road. Boom, you're going to hit the chicken. Oh, my gosh, there's, this curve is much sharper than I thought. Wham, you're going to fall over because you didn't anticipate. It's just that practice of learning where to look on the bike. It seems like that's one of the most fundamental things of riding a motorcycle. If you're a street rider or an off-road rider, that's one of the basic things you're taught. But you have to know it. You have to practice it or you're going to have issues. So yeah, the vision thing is big.
Well, and vision is more complicated than I think most riders really understand. I mean, we understand the idea you're supposed to look down the road for cars or traffic, or you should look farther than what's natural. And we know that evolution has us running at the speed of our feet or something that can run and eat us, right? We want to see food and we don't want to become food. And that's where our vision goes to. And so we have to look much farther than that when we're on a motorcycle. What I don't think people realize, because safety is one of the things that I always get asked, no matter where I go, Mexico, whether I go to, any place that's not a westernized nation, I always get asked, well, what about safety? And vision is one of those things that helps keep you safe, and not just in traffic, but in crowds, in awareness of what's going on, in getting the sense that this isn't someplace I should be. I mean, let's face it, right now, there's a lot of places in the United States that my vision will look around and go, this is a bad place to be right now. I live right next to Seattle and just north of Portland. And right now, those are two
things are happening.
I just don't want to be in a lot of places in those two cities. And this broad vision, this wide awareness that you'll see is trained for police officers, that's trained for military, where they have to be situationally aware. riders don't realize is they have to give something up. To get this wide vision, to be able to see everything around them, they have to give up the detail that's directly in front of them. You can't get wide vision and detailed vision at the same time. And that's something that has to be trained. And there's a lot of reading that can be done on this. If people get into reading about pilots and how pilots use their vision, or night vision and understanding night vision, right. If they get into tactical books, like I said, for SWAT teams, for military, they'll find a lot of different methods to do this. So I absolutely agree. Vision is a fundamental keystone of
it's of a skill. Key thing, and not just seeing, but being seen, and the situational awareness. I know I was in Central, I believe it was Nicaragua, where my visor was tinted and the sun was going down rapidly. I needed to switch it out for a non-tinted visor. And I just pulled over and took the helmet off. And it was like not an easy thing to take it off. It wasn't, you know, it was toolless, but it took a little bit longer than just snap it out, snap it in. And I had my helmet basically taken apart. Like the peak was off, the whole thing. And I looked up, there's a gang of guys with guns staring at me that I had not noticed. And
where was this again?
Nicaragua.
Where were you? In Nicaragua.
In Nicaragua. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, I knew I was in trouble, like serious trouble. And they were drunk. They were playing pool, but they all had sawed off shotguns and AK-47s or what. It was just not a good thing. And so I basically, in the riding suit, I look much larger than I am. So I looked over and gave him some one of those, like, you know, huh, I'm here. What are you going to do about it? But inside I'm like, shit. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm trying to put the helmet together as fast as I can. And I got it. It was one of those things, like, what was I doing? I was not paying attention. The other part about the vision that is an illustration, I did training at Country Tracks in South Africa. It was intense. I think it was a 4-day, all day training. It was fantastic. We did these things that I thought, why am I doing this? I'll never use this in real life. One of them was to train for the vision. They had basically an 8-inch wide piece of wood, a log, like a railroad tie, but it was really long, maybe 20 or 30 feet. And it was about, I don't know, a foot off the ground, maybe a little bit less than that. And the deal is you had to ride up on this thing and then ride all the way across and back down. If you don't look at the end of the log, you're going to go off. You're going to fall off. If you look down, you're going off. And so it was terrifying at first, but we had to do this over and over and over. And I thought, okay, that was fun, but I'm never going to use that. In Africa, I'm zipping along. The dirt roads, the way that they maintain those, they'll take tractors and they'll plow them just like a field. And so you have about 8 inches of flat ground and the rest is all tilled soil and you don't know when it's coming. So I'm zipping along. I'm like, it's the same as the log. I have to watch and think, I'm going over there, or I'm going to bite it in this dirt. And so, yeah, those exercises, they mean something. So do it.
Well, and that goes back to vision. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Knowing, and just again, this sort of evolution of vision, you talk about seeing what you want to see. You have to look to the far end of the log. One exactly. of the concepts I teach in the adventure camps and when I do the training is only see what you want to see. Meaning you have a road that's 10, 15, 25 feet wide, whatever it is, and it's all tilled, but yet you have an 8-inch strip of hard packed dirt.
That's all you have.
That's all you need to see. And the idea is that once you identify something that you're not interested in, a non-possibility, that needs to be blocked from your vision. And I learned to do this on the trails, looking for, you know, predictable rocks or little V's, you know, gaps where the rocks and the roots come together. So I know where my tire is exactly. And so being able to block out certain things becomes important as well. It's not something we do naturally. Naturally, if there's a threat, nature tells us track the threat, know where it's at. If something wants to eat me, don't lose sight of it. If somebody is threatening me, don't lose sight of them. And now we're teaching ourselves to ignore the threat and only see the happiness. You know, that's that's 8 inches of happiness all the way down the road. And again, this is where that training comes in, because our instincts are often so dangerously and critically wrong.
Yes, absolutely. You have to sometimes override your instincts to be safe. It's very important. The other critical thing I was taught that has helped me over and over and over again is riding in loose gravel. And so like the last podcast you guys did, baby heads, you talked about like the big stones. Yep. In fact, I think you have a video about gnarly gravel and rocks, big rocks. So on the training, we went through these dry riverbeds and deep gravel and all this stuff. But the thing that was really difficult for me was on those big rocks where the bike is bouncing around and you just have to be the weightless rider. You have to let the bike do what it's going to do and direct it. And sometimes it's going to, you know, tell you where
sometimes it doesn't always go exactly where you're suggesting it should go. Yes.
Right. It's this very unsettling feeling the first time you do this, so the first 10 times, maybe more than that. But, you know, that was one of those things I'm like, I don't think I'm ever going to be on this type of terrain. It wasn't my favorite part of the training. I enjoyed it because of the way it helped me understand how to be that weightless rider. What I found, though, is in Africa, in Eastern Europe, in Siberia, in Mongolia, in Patagonia, you have to know how to do this. It is essential.
And it's not common.
It's common. It's very common, and it comes out of nowhere. You can just be zipping along, and all of a sudden, whoa. But the thing that I was surprised, specifically in Russia and Siberia, Eastern Europe, is that the way they maintain the roads there is they'll, if there's a pothole, they'll just fill it up, another pothole. And so you get these very uneven surfaces, and then eventually they just grind the top of the surface off to put new pavement down. And, you know, they do that in the United States and around the world. But I don't know what machines they're using in Russia, but there are grooves in the pavement that are probably 2 or 3 inches deep, and they're almost wide enough for the front tire to go into. Almost.
Oh, wow.
If you had a skinnier tire, it could go in there. And so what happens on these roads, and it's hundreds of miles, is the bike no longer tracks like it would normally would on pavement. So you're street riding, but the front wheel is doing one thing and the back wheel is doing something else because it's trying to fall into those grooves. It is the same feeling as riding on those river rocks, but you're not on river rocks. And what happens is it feels exactly like you're on ice. It feels like the front end's going to go out, but you do have traction. It's a mental game of, I have to remember that the bike is in control. I do have traction. It will go where I'm telling it to go. It doesn't feel like it, but it will. One of the things that I learned from the River Rock experience, my instructor told me this thing. He got all of our students and he said, walk on this stuff. Just walk on it with your feet. Feel it. Now go over to the sand. Kick that around. Scuff it. Try to, you know, see what kind of traction. How far does your foot go into it? Go up to the mud. Do the same thing. So everywhere we went, we had to walk on it to get a feel of what that is. And he said, the same thing is going to be true as you're riding. The more surfaces you ride on, the more you understand how the bike's going to respond, how you're going to feel. It's like the videos you see on YouTube of a cat or a dog walking on snow for the first time. Their paws are coming up and down and they're looking really funny. It's like, what the heck is this? The same thing is true on a motorcycle. The first time you're on those pebbles or loose gravel or weird rutted road, whatever, you're like, what is this? But after you get some experience and some time, then you're able to relax and go, okay,
this goes right back.
Feels like.
Oh, and this is where we, you know, you started. You were talking about repetition, about experience, needing experience. And this is something, again, for those that are listening, it's not uncommon for me to get calls from people or emails or messages. People reach out to me in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And the message is, I'm riding well, I think, but I can't keep up with my friends. And I want to learn to ride faster. I want to be able to keep up with them. And I have to explain to them that that's not always possible. And sometimes it's just a matter of time. And the reason I say it's not possible is that you can only ride as fast as you can process information that's in front of you. And that can be limited, you know, permanently for things like vision. If I can't see the detail, I did that in South America. My ex-girlfriend, currently my wife, when we were down there, her vision was degrading very rapidly. And by the time we got down to Patagonia, we were at the bottom, when I was going across a gravel road, I could see sand, I could see hard gravel, I could see hard pack. All she saw was gray. And so she always rode as if she was about to ride into very deep sand. And we'd be, but if we got in big boulder rock, she would just tear it up because she could see it. And that's one of those limitations that, you know, speed is not our goal. You know, it's riding well, it's riding safely. But that repetition that you just mentioned, that you brought up when we first started, is about gaining the ability to quickly and accurately predict what's about to happen. You know, when you walk through that sand, and then you ride through the sand, and then you ride through more sand, and then you ride through sand that's wet, and sand that's dry, and then sand that goes up a hill, and then sand that goes down a hill, and then sand that's on the beach. Eventually, you start recognizing not all sand is sand. There are differences. Yes. And absolutely, you get better.
Yeah. And, you know, and riding with very experienced riders is fantastic because you can see how they ride, what they do, when they put on the gas, when they ease off. I rode with Eileen Martinez. She's a rider from Chile, from Patagonia, and she's done the entire Pan American Highway. She was trained by a Dakar racer. So, I mean, she's an exceptionally good rider. I've seen a lot of motorcycle riders, and she's one of the most natural, amazing riders. And just watching, we rode through Patagonia together, and she noticed one day, she said, "You're dancing with your motorcycle." You know, when it all sort of started to click, she's like, "It's like a dance." I'm like, "I've never thought of it that way, but it is. It's almost like tango when your body's in the right position, you're going around the corner, your vision is looking, everything works." You know, when you dance well, I've never danced well, but if you see a dancer who dances well, they just are fluid with the motions and it feels effortless. And when you're connected with the motorcycle through that experience, that sort of the same thing happens.
Yeah, I've used that same analogy about dancing with a bike. And over the years, I used to think, oh yeah, the bike is my dance partner. And it's me and the bike against the trail or the road. And I have changed my perception of that just slightly. Because I used to think as the bike is my bike, my dance partner. And I realized I was short on my vision for this. It's the land. It's your dance partner. The bike is just your dance shoe. It should be part of you and it should move with you. You should be looking to the land to figure out, well, if I ride up on that bank, how will the bike react? When I ride into that deep sand, what's going to happen? And you start using the land as your dance partner instead of something that you feel you have to conquer. I always tell people, smile while you ride, because attitude matters. When you're riding through rock and sand and gritting your teeth and hollering and screaming and yelling, or even saying, "I'm going to conquer you," that's not positive. It doesn't help. You know?
Yeah, the mental, the "I'm going to do this, I'm going there," you'll go there. If you think, "I don't know, I don't think I'm going to make this," you're not going to make it. Yeah, you've got to have that thing. Let me tell you about another thing I learned in Africa that I thought I would never use, but I've used it a million times. Part of the training, they brought us out. There was a large hole in the ground. It was an open field. It was probably a diameter 6 feet, maybe 8 inches to a foot deep, large enough that the bike would go inside the hole. And the instructor said, "We're going to jump over this hole." Oh, and my first thought was, "No, there's no way I'm jumping over this hole. It's bigger than the motorcycle. If you miss it, it's going to be bad." So the instructor said, "Well, let me show you how it works." And he zipped around, got enough speed, blipped throttle, did all this, basically the stuff that we learned for jumping over logs and clearing obstacles, all that stuff, same kind of principles. And then boom, right over this hole. I'm like, "I can't believe this guy did this with a 1200. He's like, "Okay, your turn." All right. So zip around, right over the hole. No problem. Like, that was a blast. I want to do that again. And it was sort of the end of the workshop. So everybody's like jumping this hole. And I thought, okay, that's fun. I'll never do that in real life. Until I got to Africa, Siberia, Southeast Asia. You're zipping down, not off-road, normal road. The potholes, many of them are 6 to 8 inches deep. They're 2 or 3 feet wide. There is no avoiding them. You have to go over these things. You can't dodge around. There are trucks coming the other way. There are cars. There's wildlife. You have to be able to clear these obstacles. And so learning how to get the front end up, to give a little gas, to get over those kinds of things, I thought, oh, well, I'm never going to use these things because I'm not doing BDRs every day. I'm not having to get over logs and branches and big rocks. I'm not, my skid plate's not going to be, you know, going through Moab, all that kind of stuff. That's not really the kind of riding I do every day, maybe once in a while. Little did I know, I needed this skill to get through the Balkans. I needed to get through Siberia. I had to have those skills to get through Mongolia. I had to have them through Patagonia, Route 40, you know, those places. And man, I was thankful. It's one of those things that I have used hundreds of times. And not having that, I probably would have frozen with fear and climbed all the way down to almost a stop and clunk, clunk down into the hole, clunk, clunk out, and been hoping, oh, I hope the truck behind me doesn't smash into me. But now it's like, oh, whew.
And Mark, what is the bike you're riding? Because you've talked about skinnier tires and the ruts in Russia. Now you're talking about running over the stuff. What do you ride?
So it's an R1200 GSA 2016, and it is not just loaded. It is fully loaded because probably 80% of my gear, cameras, lights, I've got a whole studio lighting setup, hard drives, computer. I make my living creating videos for Adorama TV and other photography brands. I have to have an entire photography studio with me at all time. And then probably once or twice a week, I'm doing what we're doing right now. I'm on a Zoom conference or a podcast or doing an interview, either as the guest or the host. And so, you know, I can assure
those listening that when you get into carrying around camera bodies and lenses and lighting and drones and sound equipment and computers and hard drives, your bike gets really heavy, really fast. I get asked all the time, well, how much was all your stuff? I just did a video for my trip through Africa. As a matter of fact, when I was in Spain, I spread everything out and I put the camera up on a ladder that was there and pointed at everything that was there. And said, well, this is it. Cause yeah, I'm not faking it. This is what I have. And there wasn't really anything missing. There wasn't anything extra. It really turned out to be an ideal packing. But the amount of weight for having sprockets and chains, and then on top of that, throwing on cameras and camera mounts and RAM mounts, and it becomes extremely heavy. And I saw one of your videos with the GSA being loaded into a boat, and I had to cover my face and peek through my fingers because I was just waiting for this thing to flip.
Snap.
With five guys or six guys, when it was loading this thing off of a dock onto a boat to take it out to a sailboat where they could hoist it up so you could get from Panama to Colombia. And it was just, it's insane to think there's such big machines. When I went through Africa, I didn't take a big bike. I bought a bike in Spain because I get to travel in short periods, 4 months at a time type of thing. And so I bought an XT600, nice little air-cooled, lightweight bike. But as you mentioned, some of the craziest off-road riding I've ever done has been in the cities. And, you know, specifically, I was in Angola and Nigeria, and some of the stuff I did in Angola and Nigeria on a bike, I've never done anything like that on a trail. All the BDRs I've done most of the BDRs in the United States, the backcountry discovery routes. And I've never done anything quite so challenging as there, and with consequence. And I can't imagine doing that on a loaded GSA full of camera gear and equipment.
Well, I've gotten it down to a science, I think, for the type of gear. I mean, the camera stuff has, the technology for higher quality camera gear and smaller packages has changed in the last 5-6 years. It's still a lot of stuff. And I have these fantasies, like, if I didn't have to make a living, this would go. And, you know, people make fun of me because in the videos, you'll notice I'm always wearing the same two or three shirts because I only have two or three shirts. When you have to figure out, well, where can I save weight? Clothes weigh a lot. Shoes weigh a lot. You know, jeans weigh a lot. So I don't have any jeans. I've got those lightweight, cool travel pants.
That's what I wear. That's the only thing I travel with is those lightweight, cool pants.
Because they're shorts, they're pants, they're great. They dry fast. They wick. They're
phenomenal.
Wash
them in a sink.
Yeah, absolutely. So the packing is, we could spend an hour on the packing, and not only packing, you have to have things balanced front to back, left to right. You have to make sure that your sensitive electronic stuff isn't too high up on the bike, especially if you're on a BDR or something. It's going to get shaken all the hell. It's going to destroy it. So you have to figure out, well, where can I put this? How can I protect it? It's maybe we'll do a different podcast on that stuff. But I doubt there's a lot of YouTubers out there that are going to ride for 6 years. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe not. But there are people who want to just record their trips. And I started carrying around, I have a 13-inch Dell XPS 13 because it has a hard drive that's solid state. So I don't have a spin drive. And technology in the GoPros with the GoPro 8 just evolved to the point that I don't carry a gimbal anymore, a handheld gimbal, because I can carry the GoPro 8. So now I can have multiples of those. Next, I need to downsize my drone. Although it was small when I bought it, it was a Mavic Pro, but now they have the Mavic Mini. I don't need 4K. 2.7 is more than enough. And there are ways to definitely start downsizing. I think there's a lot of riders that would like to bring good camera gear and be able to download this stuff and document their trips or live the dream that you dream and the great wealth and living in the fantastic Taj Mahal type living quarters that you're in on a regular basis, the magnificent food, diving in every ocean, skydiving at every airport and every opportunity. I'm sure that's what
women in
like
every
you,
port.
Right?
Absolutely. It's absolutely the same.
Yeah, because you must be a rich man traveling these years, because knows that, right? That's how you travel. You're independently wealthy, right?
Yeah. Isn't everybody independently wealthy? I thought that's how it worked. Yeah. You know, the question I get all the time is, how do you pay for this? And the answer is, well, you have to go back 30 years. I worked 30 years and created a business and did a lot of investing and did a bunch of things in my 20s and 30s and 40s to be able to get to the point where I could sell everything I own. I don't have kids. I'm not married. I don't have those attachments to worry about. I don't have any debt. I don't even have a credit card. And so I don't have those financial obligations. And at that point, then I was able to leave. And I'm fortunate enough to earn a living where I can do it anywhere in the world. So I earn my living by writing, creating articles for magazines, creating videos for YouTube and tutorials, doing workshops. I can do that anywhere in the world. Yeah, it was a lot of work to get to the point where I could start. And so it's just not something that it's realistic that anybody is able to do that. I understand that.
Well, yeah, I know you do podcasts. I know you do the photos. I know you do the articles. I know you do YouTube. I know for me, when I shoot a video, not only does the video itself take a day to multiple days, that's just going out to shoot, never mind scouting. But when I edit, for me, it's 1 to 3 hours for every minute that a viewer watches. At least. And as much as you travel and with everything you have, how far behind are you in your video production?
Well, there are two different things that I've been shooting. One is the stuff that pays the bills. So I'm the host of Adorama TV, one of the hosts. So I created that 10 years ago. We just hit 1 million subscribers last week. So I'm very proud.
That's fantastic.
So that's
congratulations.
Thank you. It was a lot of work. There's hundreds of people that participated, but that pays the bills. That my online workshops, Creative Live, any photographer that's listing is probably familiar with that stuff. Motorcycle riders have no idea what I'm talking about. So I have to keep creating that stuff, and the pressure, you know, when you make a living through social media and YouTube, it's not enough to publish a video. You have to publish a new video every week, every few days, and it has to be something you haven't done before. And if you've been doing this for 12 or 15 years like I have, it's incredibly difficult. So your brain power is, what am I going to do next? How can I do this in a way that nobody else has done it? How can I, you know, so I'm consumed with trying to do that and to do it at the level of production quality that is required of a channel that has 1 million subscribers. You can't just throw it out there like I used to maybe 10 or 15 years ago. So that has taken most all of my time. The rest of the stuff that I'm filming is the adventure. It's meeting the people. It's zipping down the road. It's the drone shots of the cities. And all of that's on a hard drive. And I made the decision a couple years ago to shoot everything as much as possible in 4K because I wanted to preserve this. My laptop is not powerful enough to edit 4K. It can barely edit 1080p videos.
Yeah, I can relate 100%. Everything I do right now is 1080p because I cannot,
my computer won't do it. Painful, yeah. I made a little promo video a couple weeks ago saying, hey, this stuff is coming. It's in 4K. It took 3 days. That video is less than 2 minutes. It took me three full days, and most of it was just waiting for the computer. I have a new computer coming here. It was supposed to arrive 2 days ago. They told me it's going to be another week. It's a beast. It's the fully maxed out 16-inch MacBook Pro. I mean, it's as maxed as you can get. It costs
a lot
more money than I want to admit. Yeah, more than a month's salary. It was a lot of money. But I should be able to edit anything with no delays. And so I've got this massive amount of material that's just about to be unleashed to the world. So probably next week we'll start to see some of that stuff, the adventures through Mongolia, the adventures through Africa, the stuff that happened in Southeast Asia, being misdiagnosed with cancer where I thought I was going to die in a couple weeks and turned out not to be true. Like, just a bunch of stories. How my bike was named Shifty Drifty by a bunch of drunk guys in Novosibirsk, Russia. Say Shifty Drifty, say Shifty Drifty. All those stories are waiting to be told. I can't wait.
So I'm looking forward to seeing those myself. I can't imagine what it's like to try to earn enough to do what you're doing on the road. I do know that when I travel, I often would give up any apartment, any house. Even when I did these 4 month trips, the only way I could afford to do them was to not have any bills at home. I couldn't afford to hold over cell phone bills, rental or car payments. Right. All that stuff had to go so I could afford it. It's amazing how affordable life can be when you don't have all these expenses that many of us just accept as part of life because of where we live and how we live. And for me, you know, I made videos for 2 years, paying out of pocket all my own expenses and with no return doing the Motor Trek series. And I moved on to doing my own channel. And that's how I ended up doing the Patreon, is just going, okay, I'm happy to make these and to give the information out, but there's no income in this. I just want to pay for the expenses, you know, pay for the equipment. And so I reached out, and of course, you know, you joined me on Patreon, and that's what spawned this whole brainchild of doing the podcast. But I have to imagine, do you have a Patreon, or do you have support as well? If people are listening, if they go to the markonabike.com and they're like, wow, this is amazing, I want to follow this guy, because it's pretty impressive, the stuff that you're doing, and I'm looking forward to what you're putting out. Is there a way for people to support you?
There isn't. There is, but there isn't. And so about a year ago, I set up my entire Patreon account with the intention of publishing a podcast. I spent a few months dialing it in, getting the music, getting the format, the audio gear that we're using now, all that stuff. And I realized that because of the way that I travel, there are times, weeks at a time, I'm in locations with no Wi-Fi. The computer's not going to keep up. I don't want to commit to people that are paying me to create content and then not be able to deliver that. And so I made the decision that until I'm in a location where I can actually deliver this stuff, I don't want to mislead people. And so in that sense, I haven't started the Patreon stuff. I was planning to be in Colombia all year this year, between Colombia and Paris. And
didn't quite work out, did it?
Did not work out. In fact, I did a podcast with Creative Live, and I said, there's all this new stuff that's coming. And people are like, where is it? I'm like, I got stuck in a pandemic. So, yeah.
I had the same thing. That's when I was doing the Motor Trek stuff. There was often 2-3 months at a time where I wouldn't be able to produce anything. And of course, I have a regular job. I work all summer long training riders. That's my profession. I've been doing this for 24 years now as a professional motorcycle instructor. That's what pays my bills. And that's why when people go, wow, you're really good at this, you should think about doing this for a living. It's the other way around. It is. Yeah. I'm sharing with the world what I've learned. Right. And for me, it's just been incredibly inspiring, because when I travel, it's about the culture. If I just want to see beautiful scenery and have challenging roads, I can stay here in the US where I live and do that. I can travel through Canada. I can go someplace like that. To me, it's that cultural experience. And next year, well, I was supposed to go this November, but COVID kind of put a stop on the borders, as you know, in much more than I do. I mean, you were in lockdown.
6 months. I've been here 6 months.
That's a long time to be stuck in a country.
Yeah.
But February, I'm going to, if all goes as planned, I'm going to Nepal, and I'm taking a group of riders with me. And if they go to my website, brettax.com, which of course most people listening to this already know that, but I'm taking them there because what we mentioned, which is how do you get across the border the first time? How do you get that first international experience where you can really feel the culture, but you're not just hanging out there on your own, where somebody's helped put things together. So there's some safety involved. And I've talked to every single person I do an interview before people sign up to go with me. And I go, all right, I'm not so worried about the riding. I'm worried about the attitude. Because if they're expecting to have a hotel with a flushing toilet and toilet paper every night, if they need to have a heater to sleep well or air conditioning, if they need to plug in their CPAP, this isn't going to work for them. All I can promise is we're going to land together. We intend to all leave on the same date together. And in between, we have a plan and expect that plan to not go smoothly.
The plan never goes. It's... You know, the ride, and maybe in the United States, you're going to do a BDR or something. You can plan X amount of miles per day, and this is where we're going to go, and this is where the gas is going to be. This is where we're going to sleep. Here's the hotel. Everything's on Expedia. It's all booked in advance, and it goes according to plan. Rarely is that the case in a different culture, because you don't want that. You won't get the experience of being fully immersed in a country if you only stay, specifically if you stay in the very touristy places. It's so much better to ride, find a place, talk to a local, go to a yurt, wherever you have to go. Say, hey, where should we sleep tonight? Where's the place? Is there a house that we can stay at? Can we camp in your backyard? Eat the local food. Order from a menu you can't read. Just say, hey, bring me whatever is the best thing you have. What's your favorite thing? I'm going to try that. Look for food that you've never eaten and just totally immerse in the culture. It's a much richer experience. Don't stay at the Ramada Inn or whatever the equivalent is, the Hilton, those places. Stay at places that you've never heard of, and it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful experience. One of my tips, by the way, essential skills, is the skill of understanding the culture. So that's one of those mental things that is imperative. You have to learn to understand whatever culture you're in, not just for the food and seeing the dances and having those conversations and stuff. It's also about the safety of the environment. When I went to Africa the first time, that was a continent I'd never been to. So in all my years of travel, 19 or 20 years of travel around the world, I'd never been to Africa. And I was a little nervous because one of the things that I'm comfortable with going to Asia or Russia or Europe or South America, I know what's normal and what's not normal. If I'm in Ecuador and there's a big gathering of people and they're banging stuff, there's a band going down the road, whatever, protests, like that's a Thursday. That's just a normal thing that happens.
All I can do is I'm laughing in the background because you're mentioning this and I'm thinking of India, I'm thinking of Africa, I'm thinking of places in South America where if I saw those same conditions here in the States, I would be quivering and terrified.
Freaking out.
And
yes,
there it is, perfectly normal and safe and routine, and what different world.
Yeah, like in Quito, the first time I was in Quito, Ecuador, I was just down the street walking to get, I don't know, something to drink or something, and I saw 40 military police in full riot gear just hanging out, and I'm thinking, what's about to happen? Only to find out that's a normal thing. These guys are just there for enforcement, whatever. And, you know, now I see that. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, it's the Thursday night gathering of the military police or whatever it is. In Central America, there's a gun in every hand, on every doorstep, in every entrance to every hotel. There's a guy with a shotgun.
Oh, yeah, Guatemala. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Guatemala, Honduras,
every liquor
Nicaragua.
Store, every entrance to the mall, at the entrance to the bank, The guy who rides shotgun in the truck truly rides shotgun in the truck. There were three guys on every single truck. There was the driver, the shotgun, and somebody to unload and to load.
And absolutely.
Yeah, every single spot. And, you know, I know for me when I traveled, I started by comparing how they were different than America. It was different than North America, Canada. And it wasn't until really probably until the time I hit Colombia that I looked back and I went, wait a minute, maybe we're the ones that are different.
We're the ones that are different.
And the more I travel, the more I recognize that America is very unique. Canada, and when I say North America, I'm talking North America, Canadians and North Americans, we are very, very, very similar. Whether I'm in Europe, which it's not as extreme, but in India, in Africa, in South America,
so
it is
so
different. And I have more similarities that I can make between those continents and countries than I could between those countries and America. We are definitely different here.
If you've never ridden in a tuk-tuk, especially if you ride in a tuk-tuk in Bangalore or in New Delhi or Calcutta, it's terrifying the first time you go through traffic in India. I mean, I remember my first trip through India in the 90s. I never slept because I was in constant panic fear of going through the traffic. I'm like, what is happening? All the horns, that stuff. Like, I don't know, because the way people go through the intersections, the stop signs and the traffic signals, they're suggestions. And you have to figure out. So one of my other essential skills is you have to learn to ride like a local. You have to learn to ride like they do in their country. If you don't, you could be plastered by a truck or run into serious trouble because the traffic laws that you and I know don't apply in a lot of countries. And so you have to adapt to that.
Now, do you do the same thing I do? Because every time I go to a new country, I always, especially crossing by motorcycle, I stop and I don't pay fixers. I went through Africa. I paid one bribe. And I went all the way down the West Coast. I did all the southern states of South Africa, you know, all up through Zimbabwe and Zambia and Mozambique and that area. Part of it is I always stop at the border. I watch where people move. I see how long they spend in certain locations. I look who talks to who, and I can figure out the pattern. I'm not in a hurry.
Yeah.
I have time. And the other thing I watch is I stop and I watch the traffic. Because one country to the next in the same region can be dramatically different. And if you don't ride like a local, even crossing the street, if you cross the street in India and you hesitate in a step, you just caused an accident or you just got hit. I mean, you cannot hesitate. You are committed. You have to cross like a local.
Yeah, and it's like walking through a crowd in New York almost. You're like, I'm going, get out of my way. And they're like, okay, that's who's going. It's not the green light. It's the thing that's going. But absolutely, I have actually video of me in Vietnam shooting the traffic circles to figure out like how do they figure out who goes? There are no signals. And it's this intuitive sense of, okay, now it's our turn. Let's go. And everybody goes. And until I don't even know how to explain how you know a lot of these places of when to go and when to stop. But one of the things that I have learned to do, specifically in South America, there's tons of little, you know, 125s and 75s, these little bikes that are zipping around between villages or around town. I follow these guys. So, you know, a lot of times they're not on the road. They're on the sidewalk. They're on the trail next to the road. They're zipping through traffic. I have a video of me riding through Colombia that is terrifying to watch until you've ridden through Colombia, because zipping in and out of these giant trucks on mountainsides, you have to do that or you're never going to get to your destination. You can't ride like you would in the United States. The other thing is you have to remember that you're in the United States when you come back.
And oh, yes.
So, I forgot.
I've never had culture shock until I came home. Everybody kept saying, you're going to have culture shock. You're going to have culture shock. And the only place I've ever truly been culture shocked is coming home after being gone for an extended period of time.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of the things that I learned, things like I'm in danger, I have to get out of this. You ride over curbs, you ride over sidewalks, you ride through backyards,
you just go where you need to go.
You go where you need to go or you're going to get in trouble. You would never do that in the United States.
You just can't do that in the United States. If you don't get a ticket to the police, then another driver will enforce their belief of what you should have done. And definitely there's a different attitude here. So let's do a quick review, because we covered a lot of ground on this. And we talked about, let's see, the first thing we talked about was it
appropriate training?
Talked about training. We talked
vision.
About vision and how to use vision, not just putting it out there, but changing how we use it and being aware of what's going on. You talked about, well, really the weightless rider. You talked about sand and gravel and getting comfortable in these really loose, major, deep, loose situations. Again, I talk about, hey, attitude matters, smile while you ride. And every time I say that, I think about deep sand, mud, heavy rock, because this is where riders sometimes forget that we did this on purpose and we're actually having fun. So we have to remember to keep smiling. And I think the last
jumping holes.
What jumping.
Else are we talking about? And then understanding the culture, riding like a local.
Yeah, ride like a local, accept what the local culture is, enjoy it. I even with food, I've discovered that. Don't eat what you recognize, eat what the locals are eating because they know how to prepare it and it's probably fresh. So
it's probably yummy, yeah.
But I can't wait to see when you find some time. Maybe the golden lining on this whole world pandemic is having the downtime for you to sort through all of this video you've collected over the last 4 years that you haven't been able to put out there. I'm sure that people who are listening to this are going to be looking for you at markonabike.com. And you said everything links there. Your YouTube is there. Any podcast you do, news, everything's on that. Just like I use bretttax.com as a center point for people to find me. And I really, Mark, this was fantastic. I loved talking to you earlier today. I love doing this podcast with you. I think that we may have something in the future. I'll bet you there's going to be comments and we're going to have future requests. People are going to want you back to do this. For those listening, also the way I'm pulling guests onto this podcast is I reach out to Patreon supporters that are at the fan club or above. And I just kind of do a random drawing or people of interest. So every month there'll be a random drawing. And occasionally I'm going to override and just find somebody that's absolutely amazing that I have to talk to that I think is so impressive that it's important to share them with everybody. And Mark was one of those picks of mine that I pulled out and said, okay, this is amazing. We've got to talk to this guy. There's so much that's going to be here. So Mark, thank you for being part of what I'm putting together here and being part of Around the Wheel. Best of luck to your future endeavors and making money and having the borders open up so you can get back on the road again.
Thank you so much, Brett. And for anybody that's listening to this, that's contemplating maybe being a patron.
Patreon.
Please do it. Yeah. A supporter. It costs hundreds of dollars to make every episode. Brett's not going to tell you that. Sometimes more than that. Plus days and days and hours. It takes a lot of work and it costs money. If you like Brett's videos, you want to learn more, you want to hear from other people, the way to do that is to support Brett. So that's my pitch. I'm not getting anything out of this except for the experience and the joy of meeting one of the people that I've been watching for the last couple of years. So thank you, Brett, for having me on. It's been really a pleasure and an honor.
Excellent. And thank you for the plug, Mark. And have a wonderful, is it nighttime where you're at right now or daytime?
It's almost it's 11 o'clock. Yeah.
Okay. So it's so afternoon for me, just going into evening. Good night to you. And for all those listening, until the next time, keep smiling because attitude matters.